We get on the phone line and welcome in our friend Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon, sir.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Well, my goodness. So looking forward to talking Beatles with you, specifically John Lennon here this afternoon. You've got a Beatles book just about ready to go called Just Like Them, A Piece-by-Piece Guide to Becoming the Ultimate Thinking Person's Beatles Fan.
I do. And it's my second Beatles book. The first one is still in the works. I thought that was going to be done first, but then this just kind of happened because it occurred to me that people write the same sort of Beatles fan piece rather than any kind of critical piece again and again and again. And it just becomes this exercise in hero worship without much thinking and nostalgia and idolatry. And I just thought, there's nothing here for people to read to really sink their minds into. And so what you get is a lot of people parroting old saws and tropes, and I just find that so hackneyed and unfulfilling, and it doesn't enrich one's appreciation of the Beatles, or more importantly, the experience of listening to them, which is something that I think is supposed to evolve as you go along in life. It's just a lot of repetition, so I thought I will do something very different, which is already what I do with everything and what I do with the Beatles, so why not put it all together in a compendium?
So what's the key to being the thinking person's Beatles fan?
I'd say it's to avoid those saws. Like, I wrote something once, I think it was for Rolling Stone, and I said something along the lines of, like, Help is arguably the Beatles' worst album. And it's like, well, unless you're just this artist beyond artist, it's like something has to be, right? Finish last. Like, it just has to be that way. And I even qualified it with the arguably. And I just got, from these hippie people, I just got all of this hate mail. There's no self-awareness in the world. There really isn't. And it was like I had challenged them personally. Like I had insulted something that was the most precious thing about them at their core, because that's how people often treat the world now. It's not about thinking critically, which enhances our enjoyment of something. It doesn't lessen it. It gives you more reason to appreciate what you like. And even when you find flaws, that can give you more reasons to like something, too. It can still be cool. It just might not be like this masterpiece, but it can be like this thing that you have a personal connection with. And I realized that no one ever went back and revisited the Beatles. They just were on autopilot. They were repeating. There were no fresh viewpoints. I've read every Beatles book there is, and for the most part, I think they're all horrible. So I thought, well, I mean, why not do something interesting and sort of treat the Beatles is literature, and literature as the Beatles, because that's something I've noticed writing about the Beatles over the years. I do not hear them like anyone else does, and that doesn't mean I distort what they're doing. I think I get closer to what that was, and it's just sort of like easy for me. It's the fastball that comes up as the beach ball. So that's how I've always written about them, and anything that I thought was just kind of like basic that I wrote about them, people would be like, wow, what a revolutionary theory. Thinking like, huh, I just thought this was like pretty clear. But my pretty clear became this, wow, revolutionary theory thing for everyone else. And I just thought, this could be good. I'll do this, the whole literature and Beatles thing, and just wrap it all together.
Well, on the blog, you posted about your 16 favorite John Lennon vocals. Let's lay out the criteria a little bit. What, in your mind, makes for great singing?
So what I did with this is... I did exactly what you said. I wrote my 16 favorite John Lennon vocals, and it's like a highly malleable list. It's not like, here's my stone, and here's my chisel and hammer, and let's set this into this bad boy. Like, it'll change, and that's part of the fun of it, really. But someone saw this on Twitter, and there was this flurry of all these people going to the website and stuff like that, and one person. Like, if someone has something smart to say, I mean, they usually don't. But if they do, I'll listen to it. Someone said the only problem with this is it's great, but the only problem is that it's not a book. I thought, well, it should go in a book, and this can be a piece in this book. So these were my favorite vocals by Lennon, who's my favorite singer. So it's not necessarily an accounting, I mean, it's not, of the best. I mean, sometimes they can overlap, certainly, and I think that happens here. It certainly does at the number one spot. But to answer your question, I think what singing ultimately is a form of communication that's often euphonic. It's pleasing to the ear. But even when it's not pleasing to the ear, like if we look at something like Billie Holiday at the end of her career, and I don't think you could say that that's euphonic at all, what her voice had become. It's like I was talking to someone the other day. You know, we were talking about someone else, and I said that they don't live. They don't. They haven't had their heart broken. They haven't taken risk in life, any risks in life, and that sort of thing. The person I was talking to said, well, not everyone wants that. And it's like, to me, it doesn't matter what you want. It's the right thing to do. It's like not everyone wants to be a good person, but that's what you're supposed to do. It's what you're tasked with being human. And so I think with a singer, what you're tasked with, what the challenge is to communicate to people. And so euphony doesn't even really matter sometimes. You're hitting someone the way that, like, Billie Holiday could still hit you, maybe hit you even harder at the end of her career. So that was something that I always dug about Lennon's singing. He claimed that he only wrote two honest songs in his life, Help and Strawberry Fields Forever, which isn't really true. But you always felt like he meant what he was singing in a sort of intensely communicative, almost conspiratorial way between you and him, even when he was, as he said to George Martin, paraphrased, that he was singing for the world.
Well, let's listen to one of those right now from 1965.
Help!
One, two, three, four!
Help! I need somebody! Help! Not just anybody! Help! You know I need someone!
That's the live version, but even in that, you can hear what you say is a controlled form of ragged in that vocal texture.
Well, not that version, though, like you said. Like, I'm very specific in everything I do. Every single word choice, everything is done for a reason. So if it was like the live version, I would have said like the live version. Like, there are instances in here where it's like take six, take one, a tie between take one and the studio version. So it's quite specific. And the way Lennon would sing Help live is a lot different than the way he sings it on the studio recording, because it was a taxing song. So it was the song in concert in 1965 when his voice would get ragged and sort of give out. Whereas, like you mentioned from the piece, it's a control form of ragged. There's more finesse, I would say, in terms of what Lennon is vocally overseeing in the studio production. So there are these moments in the song where he's singing, where the band, it's not a cappella, they don't drop out completely. Like we get sort of at the end of the middle eight of This Boy, when it's just Lennon's voice out there all on its own, completely unaccompanied. But it's like this quasi a cappella where he is doing the vocal daring do. And so it's really the voice that's carrying a lot of the urgency of the song, which is the frenetic recording if you listen to it. If you listen to it without the voice, you can hear how frantic it is, too. That it's this, Lennon had joked that, well, he actually meant it, but it comes off like a joke, that A Ticket to Ride was the first heavy metal record. There are always these people who want to claim, like Keith Richards is like the first Rolling Stones album was like the first grunge record. It's like, well, it's not, and heavy metal wasn't birthed with Ticket to Ride, but Help is borderline like heavy metal. They're really going for it in this song. And it's, as I wrote about in an op-ed once, I think for the Wall Street Journal, it's loud. This would have been shockingly loud for 1965. And Lennon sings it loud. He screams it, but unlike Twist and Shout and Money, which, I mean, are just two of the finest vocals ever, but they're not on my list of favorites, he has more control with the scream in Help. It's like that figure from the Munch, the famous Munch image, the painting, has really just commanded his vocal technique so he can do whatever he wants with it, with that sound that it's hitting you from the canvas.
Now, a very different type of song that's on your list is Girl. What is it you like about that performance?
So I wrote that it's so English as to be Chaucerian, and that was something that struck me as a teenager, that when you listen to the Beatles at their best, and I think this is integral to their best, it's just like a you're going to this place that doesn't seem to exist, but also seems to be this place that you could get off the phone and go online and book a ticket to. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like this time period is this Edwardian England. It's when Orson Welles was doing Chimes at Midnight, he was doing this homage in his mind to this merry old England that didn't exist anymore. And so I get the feeling that the Beatles were not doing an homage, but they were going to this place that didn't quite exist. It didn't just like not exist for us, like Americans. I don't think it ever really existed for them, in a sense. It's like this dream space. And that's one of the reasons why I would say that the Yellow Submarine film is so effective, because it occupies that liminal space. But what I wrote about Girl was that it's pastoral. It's something of like the fields. It's something of, if not John Clare, John Keats. John Keats would be in London more often than John Clare would be. But it's also urban and modish. And if we listen to the mix, whether it's the mono or the stereo, it doesn't matter which, the vocal is so pronounced. The voice, this instrument, is so pronounced. Again, it's not a cappella, obviously. There's a lot going on in the instrumentation. But it's one of those songs where the voice has this presence that it's like 80% of like the sonic space. In a way, it's like filling that room more than a voice usually does. If we look at it like it's kind of euphonic piece of furniture almost.
Let's listen to a little bit of Girl.
Is there anybody going to listen to my story, all about the girl who came to stay? She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still, you don't regret a single day. Oh, girl. Girl, girl.
When I think of all... They did very little that was unintentional in the studio. The breath became the hook in that song. What was the purpose of that?
There aren't a lot of singers who will just sing with breath. It's like Kevin Shields when he was making that My Bloody Valentine album, Loveless, and he heard like this refraction of his guitar sound. So it wasn't even like real sound. It was like the ghost of a sound. And he said to the producers, like, that's my sound. The producer's like, that's not even a sound, man. Like, kind of, in a way, I guess. But Lennon is sort of employing that idea with how he's singing here. It's a lot of confidence. I can't really think of any examples where someone just lets the breath, it's more than just a breath, too, for the sake of sound. It's an intake of, oh my gosh, like, this is crazy. This woman's, like, blowing my mind. It's the sound of that emotion, and it's rendered wordlessly. It's singing wordlessly, but it's also not a vocalization. It's like when you listen to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and, like, somebody gets zapped. And you have the communication of the dead air. And that's saying everything that can be said and needs to be said in that moment. And no one did dead air. So this is like the singing version of meditative dead air that we hear. So, I mean, that's like radical if you understand that. Now, that's the type of thing that I just think when I hear it. But in anything I've ever read about the Beatles, I've never seen anyone like say or write that. So again, it was sort of like part of the thinking for the book.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Who were Lennon's biggest vocal influences?
Oh, gee, that's, I think in terms of getting going with music, there was Elvis. Elvis was like the slot in the wall that you plug the cord into and then like, boom, away you go. You have electricity. But he didn't sound like him. And I think that's the key thing about Lennon, and maybe it helped that he never liked his voice, because he doesn't sound like anyone. I think he absorbed attitudes more than he did styles, and that's key. That's like a frame of mind. So he would get into a vocal frame of mind rather than like a vocal sort of like mouth space. Do you know what I mean? And that allows you to go and find your unique singing abilities. And so it's like Billie Holiday, you talk about her. Who did she sing like? You can't name a person. You know what you can name? kind of sang like a horn. So just by doing that, you're going to be your own. You're going to be your own thing. I think Lennon had certain like ideals, and he was someone well versed in the girl groups, which is a key part of the Beatles' musical evolution that no one ever talks about. And other groups at the time, they had access to these girl group recordings, and no one flocked to them like the Beatles did, and like Lennon did. And I think those girl group recordings were liberating for him. Because, again, to go back to Orson Welles said that the best artists are more feminine than masculine. And I agree with that. Lennon, in his life, was just this bastard of machismo. He was not a good guy, and he certainly did the whole northern stereotype of women have their place and all that stuff, and their place isn't, like, out in the world. It's almost like he's some servant to the male. But when he sang, he was a highly feminine artist, and maybe that's he needed that outlet, and that's where he was able to have that outlet. But he was not like some tough guy singer. He was always like this sort of tender, emoting, emotionally candid singer. So again, that was another thing that just drew me to him and gives him that accessibility that you don't get with a lot of other singers.
And a great example of that is in one of my favorite Beatles songs, Yes It Is. You write about Take One of that, and I love the way you describe it as a druggy lullaby.
Yeah, and I remember I first heard this on the Ultra Rare Tracks bootleg, and there was a series of them, and that was just like the sort of big name for them. They had come out at the end of the 80s, and I was hearing them in the early 90s, and they were these pristine like studio outtakes. And it was really interesting to me because they did not go in chronological order. There was another series of Beatles bootlegs, and these are still some of the best bootlegs that have ever been, called Unsurpassed Masters by the Beatles. And I guess they would be sort of displaced by the Purple Chick stuff that would come along later that were more exhaustive in terms of what they compiled. But I remember hearing Yes It Is, the first take, and it's Lennon, like, he's singing, and he's going through it, but he's singing it like I would sing something in the shower when I am, once again, because I don't let a day pass, when I'm rocking out to Armageddon it, because that's what I do, Kimball. And so he's just, nah, nah, nah. Like, it's like a guide vocal, but when we say guide vocal is meant for the band, so they can learn their part. But I don't mean guide vocal that way here. I mean a guide vocal like for himself, like a torch at the end of a dark tunnel, and a guide vocal in that sense. So it's like all shimmery and not definitive light, but you know that it's the real light and you're on your way. And it is such, in a way, too, it is such like a druggy song. And we don't think of like 1965 like being like sort of peak drug. But, yeah, we're getting there. And they were there in many ways in their own life. And we're experimenting and doing all this stuff. And yet, at the same time, it's such a simple song. It's almost like from a fairy tale, like a Hansel and Gretel type song with the whole notion of the color red and Little Red Riding Hood and all that stuff. So I like that he's singing to himself, but he's singing to us. And it's also fun to like sort of sing along, too.
Let's check out another John Lennon vocal, Beatles, I Should Have Known Better. What is it you like about that Lennon performance?
You don't think he can get there in the falsetto. You think that's going to be out of his range, but he does get there. And he gets there without any kind of studio doctoring. on the first, he goes for two passes to that falsetto break that we just heard right there. And he's in like single track on the mono version during that passage. And that to me is the purest example of John Lennon's classic singing. And I would say this too. I Should Have Known Better is the most Beatles song. Like, it is the most Beatly inspirited song there is. It doesn't mean best. Something like She Loves You is a much better song than I Should Have Known Better. But they did not get to that She Loves You apex as often as people might want to think. I mean, that was kind of like one of the masterpiece moments. I Should Have Known Better, it's like an ordinary moment for them, which is better than anyone else's best moment. And like, if you just wanted to encapsulate what they were about in the spirit of their sound, I'd say it's that record. And if we listen to that too, you can hear, especially once it's been cited, a real pronounced skiffle element. And A Hard Day's Night is the skiffle album. They don't do it on With the Beatles or Please Please Me, the first two, going backwards. For some reason, on A Hard Day's Night, when they have to write all of their own songs, again, something no one's ever said, they go back to skiffle. It has that kind of Liverpudlian jug band sound to it, which is what skiffle was. And so that's why that scene in A Hard Day's Night, when they're in the train, and then there's that Godard-like jump cut when they're trying to chat up the girls, and Patty Boyd is in there, and George Harrison's like, I'll marry you, but then my best friend will take you, but it'll be okay. And so like, they jump cut to the instrument, and like, everything's kind of bouncing around, and there's like a trunk that's going to fall over. It has a real homey, skiffle, lived-in vibe to it. And that's just like one of the sort of like spot-on moments of that film. I don't know if there's like a happy coincidence or Lester really understood them that well. I think probably like the former rather than the latter. But yeah, that's what I like about that vocal performance.
One of the great vocal performances by anybody is on Strawberry Fields, but there's a big difference between what most people know, the recorded version, and take one. What's the difference between the two?
Well, after 1964, John Lennon's voice is going to change a lot. And so he's going to, I would say, sing through the nose more so than from the back of the throat. When we listen to that A Hard Day's Night sound, or like the 1963 BBC recordings, he's really, he's behind the voice. And like, it's from the throat, and he's like, it's like that guy who's stacked up on the 1 yard line, and like the quarterback comes from behind to sort of push him. He's singing that way, whereas he becomes more nasally after that. And because he has to sing over the instruments on the finished version, even though it's spliced together from two very different versions of Strawberry Fields Forever, you get that pinched nasally element. You also have some studio trickeration, and the voice is somewhat doctored, whereas on the first take of the song, it's quite seraphic, like a choir of angels, but just one guy. And to me, it sounds like the very voice of introspection and of having to live in a world where you have cognitive abilities that other people don't, and how that can, one, grind you down, but two, keep you on a course to create in ways that other people can't, which is ultimately what the song is about, and following that path out of necessity. For yourself, to be true to yourself, but also for a greater good that can sometimes feel slippery, hard to hold in one's grasp, but there's a certain faith that it's out there. I mean, Strawberry Fields Forever is a song of rich faith. It's a song of rich faith in the way that Thoreau's journals can be writings of rich faith, where one is cognizant of one's identity, and as difficult as it might have, to have that particular identity, certainly still cultivating it. So again, it's the sound of that, and the first take is just so intimate, and the first take is of the song is my all-time favorite song. So like, it becomes this big ordeal, and people are like, what is your favorite song? And I have to do all these qualifiers. It's like, oh, the first take, Strawberry Fields Forever, but not the one on the anthology, because for some reason they clipped out the backing vocals, so you need like a bootleg version of it that is already sort of like been released, but not really, and then that's my answer.
All right, well, let's check out some of Take One.
Take One.
Living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
Now, why did George Martin choose a different take than that?
I think it's so interesting in that particular take, too. There's is so pronounced that Lennon's singing conversation. And now he might be having the conversation with himself that we're meant to listen to. In some ways, it's almost like my blog. But it's singing conversation. And so Lennon felt that it wasn't enough, that it was too unadulterated. So then he had these different versions of the song, and okay, we'll go with this one. And then he wanted to do the heavy thing, and he couldn't make up his mind. So it was more him than George Martin. George Martin was tasked with the patch job of just like, okay, take these two songs, really, that have nothing to do with each other tonally, and just fit them so that they can work as one song. And George Martin was able to figure that out. It's like sort of a crude way, but people are crude listeners oftentimes. I bet you a lot of them don't even notice the edit. I mean, I remember people just so infrequently talking about the bad edit in the studio version of This Boy. Like the Ed Sullivan version of This Boy trounces its studio counterpart. So that's what happened with Strawberry Fields Forever. And then, like, you could hunt these things down. And I would estimate, I mean, really, I think it's like 70% of the best music ever made has never been released. Like, I think there's more music that's great that hasn't been released than music that is great that has been. So, again, I feel like we're tasked to seek out what's in the cave, because a lot of the best stuff from the cave hasn't made it out into the light.
All right, let's set up the song that you've got, at least at this moment in time, as your number one Lennon performance.
Yeah, I do. And this one is like, it's pretty solidly entrenched. I don't think there's anything that the Beatles did that's better than the BBC sessions, especially the ones from 1963. I mean, they only did them from 62. A smattering, lots in 63, some in 64, a little bit in 65, but not too much. The 63 BBC recordings of the stuff. And the Beatles, when they set out to be, they didn't even really set out to be rock and roll stars. They set out to like get girls and have some fun, and what else were they going to do? Because most of them were pretty poor at school. And it just sort of worked out for them. They didn't really want to be Elvis. They didn't want to be Chuck Berry. They didn't want to be like Elmore James, like the Rolling Stones. They wanted to be Arthur Alexander, and Arthur Alexander is not that much older than John Lennon, but as I was saying to someone from the Grammys recently, Arthur Alexander to Lennon would have been like Yoda to Luke, you know what I mean? Like this wise sage, and like Dagobah rocks, dude, so nice of you to have me in, and he just was like this man of the world, and part of that was because he was American. Part of it was because he was black. Part of it was because of the like tonal depth of his voice. But you listen to anything that Arthur Alexander recorded, not like there's a lot of it, but he doesn't sound like a naive guy. He sounds like he kind of knows how everything works. He's like rhythm and blues Socrates. So the Beatles are covering the song in this session that is featured, gets its own piece in this book. And it's this throwdown session, like this gauntlet session,
where they're taking on all of the best rock and rollers ever. They're covering like Elvis. They're covering Carl Perkins. They're doing their own originals, and they do this cover of Arthur Alexander's "Soldier of Love." And Arthur Alexander was just the blackest rhythm and blues artist ever. Period. In their minds, in my mind, in the mind of reality, and they come to this moment, and they just hit this groove that, like, if you were Duke Ellington, you would have been like, "What? People can swing that hard? I'm Duke Ellington. I didn't even know that." And then Lennon's voice, it just sashays across the sound space. It is the sound of pure, adrenalized knowledge of how good you are and confidence, but it's not caught up in, like, "Look at me, I'm a peacock." It's just caught up in swinging, like, your ass off. I mean, it is just the vocal of vocals. And it's the moment you can hear him realize in his head, if that's possible, "Yeah. I can't just hang with this guy. I'm better than this guy. I'm a better singer than this MF-er, and here's the proof."
Here it is from July of 1963, Beatles live at the BBC with Arthur Alexander's "Soldier of Love." That good stuff. Wow.
Yeah. It is like, what? Like early 20s. And he's hanging with Arthur A. And he's beating Arthur A.
Did you know Arthur Alexander before you heard the Beatles version?
Yeah, I did. I knew Arthur Alexander when I was like 14, 15 years old. And this simply was because they covered his Anna on the Please Please Me album.
Right.
So I heard Please Please Me first before I heard any of the BBC material. And just what I would do is, it's like Chains by the Shirelles. I would have heard that. I went out and I heard all of those things. So I knew Arthur Alexander like pretty early on, yeah.
Well, check out Colin's blog for all the details. 16 great vocal performances from John Lennon on the Many Moments More blog. Colin, we thank you as always, my friend. We'll check in again next Tuesday.
All right, this is good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.